Hey guru, everyone.
Hey Guru.
How's everyone doing?
Very
Yeah,
well.
great, thank you. Yeah.
Very well.
Well, welcome to the Yoga and the Podcast, where we're discussing the autobiography of a yogi line by line. And we're currently doing chapter 12, of which we're on the eighth part of it, because it's such a long chapter. So let's get right in. So it starts. This section starts with the silence habitual to Sri Yukteswar was caused by his deep perceptions of the infinite. So he was silent for a lot of time, it would appear. And maybe then you could, Mike.
This is something that we saw often in the book so far already, where they interacted. And it wasn't just Sri Yukteswar, it was also the stories of Sri Yukteswar going to his guru Lahiri Mahashaya. They would talk, and then suddenly he said, "My guru fell into a silence," and then they would just sit there for hours together. So I think this is always a sign that he started connecting to the infinite.
True, true. I was having a debate with someone at work today about the loudness of people's radios. So in my small office of about 20 people, 20 desks, it's not a big office. There's two, sometimes three radios blaring, different radio stations. Now I moved desks because I couldn't convince someone to switch the radio off. And then today there was a radio going off on the other side of the thing, but there was really annoying songs on, like Backstreet Boys and Spice Girls, things like that. And I was like, guys,
those are the good ones, the classics.
turn the radio off. And they're like, why do you hate the radio? I was like, why do you love noise? So we're having this back and forth. But anyway, Mike.
It's very different office culture to mine. Like, everyone's listening to music there too, but everyone has headphones on, so you never hear anything.
Your office is one of good manners. Not so in mine.
You should get noise cancelling headphones, Priya. You can just put them on at work.
I've got all that kit, but I'd rather just, like, you know, be in the space, and it's nice. We have good conversations, but the radio is not fun. Anyway, silence, the importance of silence. I like silence everywhere, so apparently I can't have it at work because of the radio. There's always background noise. I like it at home, so much so that I moved to this present house. The number one criteria was silence and lack of motion in the 50 meter radius to the house, which all three of you have now seen, thankfully, is true. Mike, what do you think of silence?
I like it a lot. I think when you grow up in Germany or in Austria, if you notice, I get this feedback a lot from people who visit there. Like, it's so quiet. Why is it so quiet? Why is everyone so quiet? And I'm used to it. And then when I, for example, when I first moved to LA, you notice everything is loud. The cars are loud. The people are loud. You never have a second of silence in this town here, ever, no matter where you go. I like it that Guruji says that this is actually a value that helps advances, that is important for spiritual advancement. I didn't really know it like this before.
Yeah, I think you can see the contrast between a master like Sri Yukteswar and the practice that he keeps versus the sort of common folk. And I would put myself, you know, much closer to that bracket than the master bracket, just
no,
for clarity. And I've never been to India, but I think the feedback that I've got from many people who have been is the chaoticness. It's just chaos in places where the noise and, you know, it's overwhelming. So this is in stark contrast to what I imagined India might be like. But living in Brazil, I can say the Brazilians have a very loud culture as well, and it drives me up the wall with guys playing music on massive speakers in cars when I'm trying to meditate in my house. So it's definitely the way of the world, isn't it? It's a stark contrast in yogic practices and
Indians are probably so rooted in their inner stillness that outward noise does not detract them from that. But no, it is very loud and stark contrast to even London when you go into an underground carriage that may have 200 people in it, but not a single. You can't even hear people breathing. And if you make too much noise, everyone looks at you.
We must be practicing yogis on the train.
Exactly. Meditate. No. I can't possibly sit in complete silence doing nothing. But on the tube, when there's 200 people to talk to, and no one should talk. No one should even look in another person's direction, lest you're accused of staring or gaping. Go on, Mike.
Do you think there's culturally from north to south, the people in the north are more quiet and in the south are louder?
North, well, England.
In Europe, north of Europe.
Oh, Lauren had a strong opinion about that.
I thought you meant England.
Oh no. I think England is homogenous, but I mean, if you compare England to maybe Spain or something.
Italy.
Yeah, or Italy, or even Middle East and stuff.
I think in a way, what I saw is the effect of the sun on people. You know, if you look at the Swedish and people in Nordics, very, very different. And I equate that a lot to the sun and the energy that people get and the lifestyle then that they have. So sort of the external environments brings out certain behaviors, maybe.
So what are you saying? If you don't get much sun, then are you more quiet or are you louder? Which one is it?
You're a sunflower without sun. Yeah.
But it's an Ayurvedic concept, you know. You've maybe got more, too much heat in the system, let's say, possibly.
Let's see what God Talks with Arjuna has to say about silence. Lauren, would you? This is in chapter 3. Verse 3, there's a nice reference to it.
Union with spirit is possible only when the devotee, casting aside the superficial method of ceremonial worship or of the ineffective going into the silence, begins to practice a scientific technique of God realization. One cannot reach this goal just by mental meditation. Only deep concentration that disconnects the mind from breath, life force, and senses, and that unites the ego to the soul, is successful in producing the God wisdom of self-realization. All other methods are preliminary or supportive bypaths.
So herein lies the truth. We were talking about all those people in the London Underground carriages, 200 people perhaps, and they're all completely silent, but they're not meditating, are they? They're not, some of them maybe actually sometimes
that we know.
Yeah, that's true. Sometimes I do Hong Saw and other techniques on the train, especially if I'm running late and I didn't manage to finish all my practices at home. So yeah, but most, I think we can say with some confidence, most of them aren't doing what is described in this verse, which is actually applying a scientific technique to not just go into the silence, but to really churn the stillness and go really, really deep. Which is what we do with master's techniques. And then so the next line says, no time remained for revelations that occupy other teachers, essentially teachers that don't have self-realization. And there's a saying in Hindu scriptures that says, in shallow men the fish of little thoughts cause much commotion, in oceanic minds the whales of inspiration make hardly a ruffle. Really poetic, poetic lines, isn't it? In shallow men, the fish of little thoughts cause much commotion. In oceanic minds, the whales of inspiration make hardly a ruffle. So yeah, much very good visual aid for us to think about the concept of commotion and silence and the difference between someone who is very much, you know, in the limelight versus someone who stays in the quiet, unnoticed category. They could be the whales, which we don't notice, but Yeah, there's a very nice section from God Talks to Learners where Guruji quotes Saint Teresa of Avila. Mike, can you read this?
"You need not go to heaven to see God, nor need you speak loud as if God were far away, nor need you cry for wings like a dove to fly to him. Only be in silence, and you will come upon God within yourself."
Really reminded, she uses the bird analogy really well, quite similar to the whale analogy that Guruji has used, or Sri Yukteswar has used perhaps, or any of the Hindu scripture has used. The next line says, because of a guru's unspectacular guise, only a few, because of his guru, i.e. Sri Yukteswar's unspectacular guise, only a few of his contemporaries recognized him for who he was, i.e. Some avatar, you know, Gnan avatar. Like,
I think that this is the other side of the coin. So if you are in silence and you focus on this spiritual vibration in your ashram, then the highly developed students that you have, they will be drawn to you. But the world, they want someone who is loud, who is assertive and tells them, gives comments on everything, right? And shares the wisdom, or like Guruji says, under quotes, gives revelations. So I guess in that sense, that wasn't a priority for Sri Yukteswar.
In work, though, would you prefer someone that says a lot and says 9 good things for 1 bad thing, or someone that says nothing even if he's got loads of good things to say?
I think the boring answer is that you need some balance there, right? it gets annoying if somebody shares all their opinions, but somebody doesn't say anything, then it's pretty useless. In work, you need to speak up, I would say. More often than not.
You say boring, I'd say cop-out answer, perhaps.
Mm.
You have to, come on, Mike, if you're hiring, which one are you going to go for?
Yeah, no, I think I gave my answer. I don't think the quiet one is going to get the job.
I'm surprised, Mike, being a techie guy, you didn't say feel fast, you know, move fast for feel fast or something. It's the motto of the tech
fail
industry.
Fast. Fast. Yeah, break things years. And fix them later or something.
Something like that, yeah.
I think if you can nurture that silent, I've met a lot of those silent ones that don't like to speak in meetings and don't like to even say when they know something, if someone is, we're going down the wrong path, they won't say anything. They'll just stay quiet. I've met many of those and worked with many of those. But if you have to approach those people quite differently, right? You have to manage them in a different way. So they respond much better in one-to-one settings than they do large, you know, meetings with lots of people and lots of ideas and 10, you know, people that are 10 times as loud as them and say 10 times much more as more nonsense as them. But if you can really nurture that relationship and turn that from that quiet person and build that trust, then it takes much more effort. But equally, you can get, I think, you can get much more nectar out of them than you would from someone else. So they've got a lot to offer, but it just takes much more patience and a slightly different approach to get them to contribute as you know they can or that they're capable of. Mike?
You're spoken like an experienced engineering manager. I think that's exactly right. You need to approach everybody. The only problem is that at work, sometimes it's crunch time and you need to get, it's there's power struggles, and then those people are like pretty useless. So it's not own, like the manager can make up for a lot, but I don't think he can make up for it 100% if they don't communicate.
Yeah, those guys aren't definitely not for the crunch time. They're for the, the quiet, the steady times. Chris?
There's a differential really between the quiet person and the person who does speak when they should speak, like when you kind of have a duty to speak. So in this instance, we're talking about work. You're getting paid to do a job, and therefore you should actually step up to the mark, even if you're quiet, to be able to put in your your effort and do that. But I find there's a big difference in cultures. You know, I've worked with people all over and hired people all over the world, and that's a much bigger problem in certain cultures than others, because they have a more hierarchical, you know, stance, which, you know, in this sense, you know, you don't want to talk out of line and sort of make somebody look foolish, or, you know, and correct somebody, or so on and so forth. So, yeah, it is an interesting take. My dad is definitely on this spectrum, where says very few things, but when he does say something, it's always, you pay attention to, he's that kind of person in the room. So I kind of learned from that, and then there's definitely value in that. So people actually pay attention, versus praying to your example, like somebody says 100 things and they get it wrong, so many times people might stop paying attention to them as well. So I'm with Mike on this. It's a balance.
So that's what we would say about worldly pursuits that we have in our jobs and other place, other walks of life. But here we're talking obviously about Sri Yukteswar, and or Guruji is describing Sri Yukteswar, and he's saying that because of his unspectacular guise, very few people recognized him. And it's such a shame that we rely on an outward show of you know, social skills to judge a person, and this is to the detriment of all his contemporaries, Sri Yukteswar's contemporaries, because they didn't acknowledge or see past his stoic poise and his, you know, silent outward expression of his divinity. Chris,
I'm reading one of the lessons, earlier lessons in the new lesson form, and it sort of talks about this, where it's saying that Maya delusion is what takes us away. It repulses us from the attraction of God, and that is in the physical form. So everything really in the physical form. And so then what we should do is interiorize and, you know, be attracted toward the inner world. You know, we're made in the image of God in the astral and causal and so on, that exists there. So if you think about it in this way, that somebody who's sort of vying for attention in the physical, or somebody who is too absorbed in the physical world of Maya, they simply will not see the higher aspects of an individual, in which obviously we're being shown here with Sri Yukteswar, existing in such a high state of realization, that the people wrapped up in Maya are simply not going to be able to see it. So, yeah, that's going to be 99% of people, I guess, just with the way that evolution of spirit works. So it just is what it is, probably will be for a significant amount of time.
And then there's an adage that's linked to this. It says, he is a fool that cannot conceal his wisdom. And Guruji says that this can't ever be applied to my profound and quiet master. I was very confused by this line, but thankfully the others explained what this meant to me. Mike, do you want to have a go what this means?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it basically, he prefers the way that Sri Yukteswar handles his students. He's not somebody who speaks out a lot, and he keeps his wisdom to himself. And you really have to ask for his wisdom, or it really comes only in certain moments, not all the time, which I think it's probably a very nice way to learn something. If you get scolded all the time, it might be more difficult. But I was wondering, how do you guys think about that? What kind of master do you imagine? Somebody who keeps quiet most of the time, or somebody who keeps sharing his wisdom more and talks more openly?
I say I would expect, if I was with Yogananda, I'd expect mm-hmm. him to speak out every single time I make a transgression against some physical or mental or spiritual law, or his, any of his guidance or teachings, because that is how that's kind of what we're used to, isn't it? Doing the doing it the other way, where like they, if he makes you think about what you've done or what you've done wrong, then that requires a lot more effort, because you have to introspect a lot. Mike, Chris.
Yeah, I guess here's it's saying only a few of his contemporaries recognized him as a Superman, and that he essentially concealed his wisdom. But from that, I'm combining the two. Really, he concealed his wisdom to contemporaries. He wasn't going that way. He didn't act that way to his disciples. That's what I take from that. So we talked about before with Yogananda submitting himself to Sri Yukteswar. And we know that Sri Yukteswar really corrected Yogananda when he did even the slightest thing wrong, even when it was barely perceivable from Yogananda's point of view, when he lost concentration or something. Sri Yukteswar knew. So he had great wisdom that he shared with Yogananda on a regular basis. But to the lay person who might have come and gone, as we know, would have asked him for advice and things like this, it, generally what I would consider as contemporaries, I think he was very much more reserved. And simply did not go out and try to change people, you know, forcibly. So for those in his close quarters, I think he acted quite differently compared to people who came and went.
Yeah, I mean, I think at the end of the day, he is, even if he's in the body, he wants you to have this intuitive perception of what he wants, not having to say everything all the time. If you are a spiritual teacher and you have to go after your students all the time and tell them what to do, it becomes tedious, I guess. So, and for us who follow Yogananda, who is no longer in the body, it's a similar relationship, right? So I feel like even if he was in the body, he would want us to be in tune with him. And I think Yogananda himself, he stressed often the importance of being in tune with the guru.
Especially for all his editors, Dharamata and co, that had a lot of important duties for all the rest of us in the future generations that were his devotees. Because especially Dharamata had to, you know, use shorthand to capture a lot of Guruji's, you know, talks and stuff, and how well she's done it. And if she couldn't tune into what he meant and what he said, so if she couldn't compress like all those fantastic lines that Guruji uses into just a few words, which is what she did, and she was obviously a professional at afterwards, so we wouldn't have all the great books that we do. Otherwise, can you imagine? We would have such a little material. So we're thankful to the master's closest disciples that they were able to tune in to what he meant and what his teachings were as well. So this the saying, he is a fool that cannot conceal his wisdom. So this also implies that the people that do spout their wisdom willy-nilly is a foolish endeavor. So this kind of comes back to, you know, when we always refer back to Guruji's teachings, where you don't talk about all your spiritual experiences, you know, your profound insights and stuff. You don't just go bleating them out everywhere to anyone who will listen, or people perhaps even who won't listen, like all those preachers done on public transport and whatever. So that is, I think, what this is referring to, like the mana or the amrut that we're gathered or developing in our, through our spiritual path and our sadhana. We don't want to spill it. We want to cherish it. So we want to keep it for as long as we can and bask in it. Sri Yukteswar obviously had infinite knowledge, and yet he kept quiet mostly, especially around his contemporaries, which is a good example for us, even though he was an avatar and the others would have benefited greatly. But if they're not ready to listen, if they're so steeped in their ways, then Guruji, Param Guruji, is wasting his energy, isn't he? There's people in his ashram that are much more receptive, perhaps, than his contemporaries. Yes. Let's move on. So the next section is, though he was born a mortal, Sri Yukteswar achieved unity with the ruler of time and space. Really beautiful line. Just essentially self-realized. Self-realized master, isn't it? Another way of saying the same thing. Lauren?
I feel like there's something really subtle in here. You know, it says, though born a mortal like all others, he achieved identity with the ruler of time and space. I feel like Guruji's also saying, well, Sri Yukteswar can do it because he was born this, like everybody else. So can you. You know, that kind of sense of, well, it's available, right? If you apply yourself.
Mm. And it goes further. He found, Master found no obstacle to prevent his emergence of the human and the divine. And then Guruji then further backs this up and applies it to us and says that actually no barrier exists other than man's lack of spiritual adventurousness. So let's talk about spiritual adventurousness, because here Guruji is essentially telling us to be that way, I think, because that's what's not doing that is preventing us from our emergence with the divine and achieving our identity with the ruler of time and space. I remember we just this weekend we had a young adults meeting, and we have a new young adult, and he's going to come and join us as a guest very shortly. But he led the activity, and he picked one of the activities that was probably the most adventurous. So what happened was we had to each of us had time to introspect, and we all wrote down things that we say that we can't do. So you might say, I can't have good control of my diet, for example, or I can't not be overly critical, or I can't meditate twice a day for long periods without losing focus, or, you know, consistently. These are all my I can'ts, by the way. And then what you do is you write it down, and then what he did was he read some affirmations, or we found affirmations that counteract those I can'ts. And then you essentially go through a prayer which essentially says that today is going to be the funeral of those I can'ts. Mm. And then we're going to have a cremation ceremony for those. And Kianda, because of, you know, health and safety and fire regulations, he bought a plant. He bought a flower plant, a rose plant, and he said, "Okay, let's write all these down, put it in a pot, and then we'll go bury this outside somewhere. And then that's going to be, you know, it's going to, those I can'ts will be merged into the earth, whereas we will now be everything that is I can." And I said, no, this is so good. This is such a good young adults meeting. Let's break a couple of rules. So I said, let's actually have a cremation ceremony. So we actually, we took a fireproof pot. And thankfully, two of us are like fire wardens and things like that. So we kind of knew what we were doing. And we took a fireproof pot and we put all the pieces of paper that that everyone had written it in. And then we put it all together. And then we had a little cremation ceremony outside for all those I can't, and it was so powerful and so symbolic, and you can sense that you know, doing something with that much adventure, not just adventurousness but zeal kind of thing, it's more impactful. And I know it's like a ritual, right? But you can use rituals to amplify your endeavors. And I think that's what we kind of did there. So do you guys have examples of spiritual adventurousness in such a way? I mean, I know you guys do a lot of pilgrimages, and that's probably a very simple method of being adventurous. Mike?
I do feel like it's like you're in charge of a big ship, right? I see my life as a big ship, and sometimes I see me drift in the wrong directions, and then I have to do something drastic to correct course, kind of, be it joining a silent retreat or some doing a asking one of my devotee friends to spend the weekend together or something like that, and just say no to things, because life gets too worldly super easily. So sometimes you need to just course correct, and I think maybe that counts as spiritual adventurousness.
What about when you hit an iceberg, Mike?
Then ship sinks, and yeah, that's it.
you gotta do something. You can't go down with the ship.
I'll be on one of those. On one of those doors, right?
You'll be playing the violin. I'll go like,
Rose, you stay on the door. Huh? Yeah.
Mike, we need a heroic story from you of how you overcame the iceberg.
Take the door, Rose. I'll be fine. I'll be fine.
It was a piano, wasn't it? A piano? No, it must have been a door. Sorry. No.
It was like a plank of wood of some sort, wasn't it?
Plank of wood that could clearly hold two people.
Yeah. One had to go.
I don't think I'm ready for an iceberg. I don't want an iceberg, please.
No icebergs. No.
Yeah.
But even if you did, Mike, you could still overcome.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Right?
Sure.
Yeah. And like, this is the thing for me. I feel like spiritual adventurousness is really something that is born within. And, you know, it comes from how we live our lives, how we, you know, practice, and how we kind of think about this journey back home, right? You know, like for me, I think, well, there's no question I have to get home in this reincarnation. That's it, right? And it's just no option for me, right? But, you know, for some that's different, and they prefer to think, well, you know, it's okay in a few reincarnations or whatever. But it's that kind of, I think that's where adventurousness lies. It's going, well, actually, I have the potential to do all that Guruji speaks of, and that's available to me. I just need to apply myself and obviously get past all these mountainous karmic things, right? But, you know, it is a potential, and it's there, and it's available to us all, and we can all do it. But it's having that zeal and that kind of gumption and that adventurousness to go, actually, yeah, I'm going to go for it. You know, so yeah, for me, adventurousness is a something that comes from inside.
Yeah, I think, yeah, I like what's been shared. And if people are maybe worried about being adventurous, start small, and then you're spiritually adventurous. But start with what you can do in your own life. Like, I went to, just like Mike was saying, took some time to do a retreat, and it was silent until lunchtime, and then you could talk post lunch. But I decided to do this silent retreat full time, 24/7, and I really am really happy that I did it. And I suppose that is an example where it was a little bit more adventurous with what was even being offered, and you can still go to that little bit more effort. And for me, it was a big reward. So. Yeah, there's going to be something in everybody's day-to-day life that, you know, they can be a little bit more adventurous and probably get big rewards from.
Indeed. I found a interesting reading on this in Metaphysical Meditations, and I have got Chris. Hopefully you can read it out for us.
Sure. I will use my creative thinking ability to gain success in every worthwhile project that I undertake. God will help me if I also try to help myself. I have buried dead disappointments in the cemeteries of yesterday. Today, I will plow the garden of life with my new creative efforts. Therein, I will sow seeds of wisdom, health, prosperity, and happiness. I will water them and self with self-confidence and faith, and will wait for the divine to give me the rightful harvest. If I reap not the harvest, I will be thankful for the satisfaction of having tried my best. I will thank God that I am able to try again and again, until, with his help, I do succeed. I will thank him when I have succeeded in fulfilling my heart's worthy desire.
That's beautiful. And I love that Guruji always stresses this point that there's the saying that help yourself, then I don't know, I messed it up already. But if you help yourself, then God will help you, the essence of it. We have to do our part praying and also doing in the world, right? And use our creative thinking. It's so beautiful how he says it, right? We have to use this intellect and this mind that we got to go after our goals and pray, and then God will push us over the hurdles, right? But if we don't try, if we just hope for the best, then it won't go far.
Indeed. One thing that I don't think this sentence about spiritual adventurousness is encouraging is for us to try many, many different spiritual techniques and paths, which is a common thing in today's day and age, where try a bit of this, it's fun, try a bit of that, that's fun, just and keep keep good, keep going, keep doing, and keep going in that way. Because you dilute whichever process you're doing, you'll dilute it, and it won't come into fruition, the ultimate. But Guruji has told us that this, Guruji has given us everything here in the teachings that we will ever need. So being adventurousness, after you've found, if you're confident that this is the path, then you need not try new things, as it were. There's enough new things to try within this path. I mean, only after about maybe 15 years did I actually start doing affirmations, would you believe, in the path. I just used to read them, in the lessons. They come, that's nice, read it, meditate a little bit, and then just carry on. Whereas obviously now I'm much more about using the affirmations as a mantra and making it a tool for your transformation. Chris?
Yeah, I read recently Guruji saying that what is important, and God recognizes this and rewards it, is the last line there where it says, my heart's worthy desire. I think that's really important and a worthy way to finish that reading in Metaphysical Meditations, because it's the intent. It's not necessarily doing the actions over and over again and hoping for a result, but it's the intent. Even if you do really struggle, if your heart's desire is truly there, you're truly trying to make progress, no matter how many times you fail, you keep going. So yeah, I read that about with Guruji's wisdom that he shared, and ties into this paragraph very much.
Yeah, what you just mentioned, Priyang, is the principle of loyalty, right? We talked about this a few episodes ago. And on my kitchen cabinet, I have one of those little cards. This one is, there was like a devotee at Lake Shrine, and she was handing them out randomly. And I drew loyalty. And I also drew perseverance. I drew two, actually. But those are both. And I would like to read, there's a little paragraph on here. It says, through your loyalty to God, you can establish your oneness with him. Realize your soul's perfection. Be loyal, as loyalty attracts divine attention. When the storms of life gather and the waves of trials buffet you, guide the boat of your life safely to the divine shores by realizing his omnipresence. Loyalty is very important.
Highest spiritual law.
Indeed. Yes.
Let's move on to the next paragraph. I think those last three paragraphs we've done sufficient justice. I think 10 minutes per paragraph. Mm-hmm. We're going for a new record here. So the next section really is about a master's touch, a master, not just any old master, but the highest master, i.e. an avatar, and Guruji Paramhansa Yogananda reflects and he says, I was always thrilled at the touch of Sri Yukteswar's holy feet, which is pretty nice. He says, a disciple is spiritually magnetized by reverent contact with a master and a subtle current is generated. Mike.
Amazing. Do you guys think, so I'm sure when you do your meditations, you bow before an altar or a picture of Guruji. Do you think this is an equivalent feeling, or is it possible to have that at home as well, even if it's not presently in the body?
What a deep, deep question. First, you have to answer it.
I feel like there is something special. I love this Indian custom. You know, in the West, it's not done as much. When you meet the monks in the West, you bow before them or you pranam. But I noticed when I was in India that there was a lot more reverence towards the monastics, and everyone would come in, touch their feet, bring presents, and that was just a very important part of showing gratitude and reverence to them. And I don't think that is something that's done in vain. I think that is a powerful thing to do.
Interesting way around you said it. You asked, do you bow down before you meditate? And I usually bow down, but it's usually after my meditation. Perhaps I should start experimenting doing it before as well, Mike. Interesting. Mm. Very interesting. Because even at the center, people, when they come in, they usually just come and meditate. Few people actually do go to the front and pranam and then come back. So yeah, this is good. Good advice. Thank you, Mike. And in reference to your very deep question about, do you think we can have this same impact with, Guruji, what Guruji had when he touched Sri Yukteswar's feet? Can we have the same impact when we just bow here in front of our altar? And perhaps if you don't even have an altar, just bow even, you know, before a meditation, not in any particular direction or with any picture in front of you or whatever. You can just bow down mentally, right? Imagining Guruji is in front of you. So I think it's a very deep, deep thing, but actually I don't think there's a difference. If you can put yourself in that state where you realize you believe Guruji to be in front of you, and you believe it with all your will, then Guruji is obviously omnipresent, right? And there's no reason for him not to be with you in your meditation. I mean, they say never meditate alone, right? That's not just a saying, but that's something that we should be practicing. Each of our gurus, we invoke their presence at the start of every meditation, and that is who we're bowing down to at the start. So I think really it comes down, Mike, in answering your question, it comes down to us. And you know, he's literally answered it in the previous question. No such barriers exist between the human and divine other than our spiritual unadventurousness. So we need to in our imagination and our willpower, we need to be very courageous and adventurous in that regard. Chris?
I was gonna ask on the basis of every prayer in the beginning, you know, we, as you said, Priyank, we pray to meditate with the masters. We say, you know, since of all religions, we bow to you all. Do you guys actually physically bow? Because I do in imagination, but I always find my head like it's heavy. You know, I always physically bow. So, you know, no matter if it's imagination or physicality, I just wonder if you guys find the same thing, always end up sort of finding my head goes heavy at that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I must say I bow always when I meditate at home. And at the temple, when it's like busy and stuff, not really, but like, for example, when I volunteer in the morning and I got the place to myself, then I bow as well. So, I don't see too many people doing that, so I don't want to make a scene or something, but I do think it is the least I can do to my guru.
I went on this a Guru Puja course a couple of months ago now, and I've been doing this mantra before some of my meditations, of which I think I chanted part of it a few episodes ago. And one of the philosophy or the thinking is that if you do it with such reverence and devotion, then the guru has no choice but to come and manifest in some form in front of you. So if you, and that is what I've been trying to practice. So again, going back to Mike's question, do you think, you know, doing it mentally is the same? It's completely down to you and your own outlook and how much you actually believe in God's omnipresence or Guruji's omnipresence. So that's much, much great food for thought for us. but this subtle current, he was saying, a disciple is spiritually magnetized by reverent contact with the master, and a subtle current is generated. We've got a few very beautiful and touching examples of this subtle current that is had not just by Mukunda or in Paramahansa Yogananda later, but actually other devotees as well. And let me take you through some of them. One of the first ones was our most favorite subject, the amulet. When he used to touch it every now and then, he said, a blaze of illumination came over me when he first touched it, when he possessed, you know, in possession of the amulet. And he said many dormant memories were awakened. And then he also went further and he says, as a small boy, you know, when he was thwarted by his attempts to reach the Himalayas, he traveled far on the wings of the amulet when he was clasping it in his hand, no doubt. So, and then he says, like a spiritual yeast, it was silently at work within me. So you can imagine him meditating, can't you, with it just in the palm of his hand and just flying to some unknown realm in his meditations. So that's another spiritual subtle current that he was enjoying. Another really lovely example is, you'll remember the humble devotee Ramu, the blind devotee that was fanning Lahiri Mahashaya, and someone asked him, why don't you ask Lahiri Mahashaya if he can heal you? And then Ramu said, okay, fine. He asked Lahiri Mahashaya, and then Lahiri Mahashaya said, someone's tricked you, Ramu. You know, I don't have any such power to heal. And then Ramu very cleverly responds and says, surely the divine that operates within you can heal me. And I'm obviously paraphrasing it. I don't have the actual paragraph, but I do have what then Lahiri Mahashaya says in response to that very beautiful statement. Lauren, do you want to read it out?
He says, that is indeed different, Ramu. God's limit is nowhere. He who ignites the stars and the cells of flesh with mysterious life effulgence can surely bring the luster of vision into your eyes. The master touched Ramu's forehead at the point between the eyebrows.
A few hours later, vision. So yeah. Another not so subtle current this time. And there was also, you will remember, Yogananda's own Kriya initiation, which he describes what happened. Chris, do you want to read it out?
But Master possessed a transforming power. At his touch, a great light broke upon my being, like the glory of countless suns blazing together. A flood of ineffable bliss overwhelmed my heart to an innermost core.
So lots of not just subtle, but very profound currents that are being generated, especially when, you know, Guruji is being either touched in his heart, prodded in at the heart, or at the spiritual eye, Ramu was experiencing that. So Guruji in this section goes on to describe that a devotee's undesirable habits are cauterized in the brain, and the grooves of his tendencies are disturbed worldly tendencies. So the touch does more than just give you a little bit of a fleeting glimpse of a light, perhaps, but actually you may not know, but all these things could be getting jarred and disturbed and loosened, so you can overcome those. And that is true even for you when you bow down before and after your meditation. You don't know, or off most of the time you won't know what impact bowing down has, right? But we live in faith and don't ever discount what the guru can do for us. Yeah, the famous saying, like, you may be walking at a snail's pace towards gods and gurus, but they're running towards you. So it's just facing. Are we facing the right direction? That's all we have to worry about. And then it further goes on and describes that momentarily, at least, he may find that the secret veils of Maya may lift, and that you may glimpse the reality of bliss. Really, really nice words here, isn't it? To inspire us to be reverential. He said, my whole body responded with a liberating glow whenever I knelt in the Indian fashion before my guru. So Chris, when you feel your head heavy, you have to keep going down until your head and forehead touches the ground. And you imagine Guruji's feet just a few inches, in front of your forehead, perhaps. Because here, look what he's saying. My whole body responded with a liberating glow whenever I knelt in Indian fashion before my guru. Mm. Powerful words, and ones we should make use of. It's a really nice technique here to not just build faith, but to benefit from our devotion. Mm-hmm. So moving on. So now Sri Yukteswara talks about essentially transmission of knowledge when he was with Lahiri Mahashaya. So he says that even when Lahiri Mahashaya was silent, or when he conversed on other than strictly religious topics, Sri Yukteswara said that he discovered nonetheless that he'd transferred to him an ineffable knowledge. Now, this would imply that just being in the presence of a guru, you may not know or not even be in the conversation. They may be talking about something that's not at all spiritual, but apparently there's ineffable knowledge that's being transferred through this. So every word and perhaps posture or, you know, smile or gaze that a guru has would have some sort of transmission of energy. Chris?
I think this talks to as well the strength of intellect and perception that we all have. Like, it's all innate in the human form. And like in lay terms, people call it the rub. If you get the rub off somebody else, and often sports, you know, if a lesser ability sports person would play with one with much higher ability, they would get the rub. So they would actually be able to learn much faster, and they would make leaps and bounds toward becoming better at that thing. So, you know, humans are miraculous. Like, we have such real perception and ability to, with the right enthusiasm and intent to learn. And this is why Guruji often says environment is stronger than will, right? So we all learn from each other and rub off on each other in a good way.
Mm.
And bad.
Rub of the green as well when playing golf. Is it going in the same direction that your ball you want it to go to? So I found a very good reading on this topic about the transmission of knowledge in Swami Sathyananda's book on the life of Lehi Mahashaya. And Sri Yukteswara describes it here in a bit more detail, actually. So if you want to read this, Mike.
He would impart knowledge to his disciples through gestures, hints, conversation, jokes, and also in profound seriousness. Any questions by disciples in letter form would be returned to the questioner with the answer written very concisely by him on that very paper. Swami Sri Yukteswar Giri used to say, sometimes I would come back after sitting around and having small talk and ordinary conversations with Gurudev, and suddenly I would become astonished to realize that I had unknowingly come back with a great deal of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Sneaky, yeah.
Yeah, Guru has to use all the tools that are in the toolkit to transform you. And Guruji Paramhansa Yogananda says that his Guru Sri Yukteswara also infected him similarly. And then that he said that when he entered the hermitage, when he was worried or indifferent, his attitude changed. And then he said a healing calm descended even just by looking at his Guru. Beautiful. Do we have that? Do we have that similar feeling when we look at our altar or when we go into any of our centers and peer at the famous six? Yes. Each day with him was a new experience in joy, peace, and wisdom. And this is quite a nice concept. A new experience, ever conscious, ever new, ever existing bliss consciousness, isn't it? A bit like that. So I found a very nice section, the Second Coming of Christ, in Discourse 9, where Jesus meets his first disciples. Lauren, would you like to read that out? And Chris, you can carry on.
As each person carries with him a telltale silent evidence of his own vibrations, individuals residing in the same house, sharing the same rooms, soon come to know each other, even if they verbally communicate very little, because of an exchange of the magnetic vibrations of their consciousness, nature, vitality, and feelings. Each feels the silent emanation of the other's thoughts and life force, and the range and strength of his vital magnetism. Unbiased, spiritually sensitive souls can know people simply by looking into their eyes, or by merely coming in close proximity with them and feeling their radiating vibrations. Worried, calm, timid, brave, cruel, wise, or godly vibrations can be felt instantly, even by people with little spiritual perception.
Persons with ordinary perception are usually sensitive to others only when within near range of their magnetism. Great minds, however, can feel another person from a distance, although receptivity is stronger if they have been closely associated for a while.
So it's if we really tune into our intuition, we can use this not just to, you know, feel the good, and you know, in terms of our devotion to God and gurus and our brother and sister disciples, devotees, but also keep us away from perhaps negative influences, which is what he's kind of referring to here. So we further read in this section, in the autobiography. The next section is, never did I find him deluded or emotionally intoxicated with greed, anger, or human attachment. So Guruji, Param Guruji, was not just inspiring to be around, but there was no he says never. So there was no negativity that we would experience from other, you know, worldly people that might be in our lives, or, you know, in our workplace, or friends even, perhaps every now and then. So this is quite a thing, isn't it, to be living in this ashram? Quite a privilege. But this is, next line is telling. He says, so the darkness of Maya is approaching, Sri Yukteswar would sometimes say, let us hie homeward within. This is pretty random place to have this, isn't it? Because there's just those beautiful, those five or six beautiful paragraphs about, you know, Guruji and how he used to essentially be, when it was, what it was like touching his feet, all these things. And then he briefly mentions that Guruji was never greedy or angry or had a human attachment. But then he says the darkness, Sri Yukteswar would say, the darkness of Maya is silently approaching, let us hie homeward within. Lauren?
I'm wondering if it's not so strangely placed, because I feel like, you know, we can get so enamored with the beauty of the spiritual life that we can forget how strong Maya is, and that it is always here and it is always trying to bring us back, you know. And if we're not watchful, we will get caught up in it. And, you know, I feel like it's actually a reminder of, yeah, you can be even at your guru's feet, but you still need to be watchful of Maya and go within, right? And I feel like perhaps this is why it's there in that place.
Mike?
Yeah, and having a guru helps you to maneuver Maya a little bit and make it perhaps more enjoyable by dodging maybe some of the karma and having more feeling, being more connected with your heart and your soul. But that doesn't mean that this is what you're looking for. That's kind of what the great masters always remind you of, that this is not, I'm not here to make Maya nice for you. I'm here to get you out of it.
Very well said, Mike and Lauren. I actually also thought that we can, in these pages, there's just pure devotion, isn't there? We can get drunk with the devotion in these words, which is very nice. But remember, the formula for our spiritual path is griya plus devotion. So we can get drunk in this devotion. But remember, all of our services have a reading, and they don't end with a reading. You have to then have a period of meditation. So here we've had very beautiful few pages of readings, but Guruji wants us to put the book down and practice Kriya every now and then. So that is why I think one of the reasons why it's there. And he's just put these kind of bits here and there to remind us that we have to keep our practice of Kriya, even whilst reading the autobiography of a yogi or any of Guruji's writings. And then here he says, with these cautionary words, Master constantly reminded his disciples for the need of Kriya. So he would appear, apparently this is a common thing that Sri Yukteswar would say. Really good line, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I think I may have to get the old red highlighter out there for that. The darkness of Maya is approaching, silently approaching. Let us hie homeward within.
Yeah, it doesn't come loudly, does it? Creeps in silently.
And then you fall. The fall hurts. The fall hurts. Your iceberg hurts, Mike, doesn't it?
It does. Knocks. We don't want the iceberg. Yeah. No.
All righty. Okay, so the next section really is about doubts. It says a new student would occasionally express doubts regarding his own worthiness to engage in yoga practice. It's really, really sad, isn't it, that this line And Guruji really nips this in the bud. But once Yogananda does in lots of his teachings and the lessons, but also Sri Yukteswar does, because he says, forget the past, you would console them. The vanished lives of men are dark with many shames. Human conduct is ever unreliable until man is anchored with the divine. Everything in the future will improve if you are making a spiritual effort now. Really, really powerful lines, isn't it? Because I'm sure we all go through these doubts of our worthiness for this great, great spiritual path and this great lineage that we belong to. But we have to forget the past if we have a troubling past. Whether or not we do is probably just because of what we can remember in this life. But if we had the whole picture, I'm sure all of us have a past. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. Mike?
I think this is probably the most cited line by Sri Yukteswar. Heard this so many times, but it's so powerful because it, when you are, especially when you start on the spiritual path and you feel like your life does not look like the life of a spiritual person or of a yogi. And a lot of people then try to make that transition in a, like one big 180 degree turn. It's difficult and it takes time. And I think that a lot of the great masters, I think Jesus said something similar, right? Like he who is without sin, throw the first stone and all those kind of things, right? It's really, you have to start somewhere. And as long as you are in this delusion, you will just keep creating karma. But then once you have a connection with a guru and once you start making your way out of it, then it can be done. And your sin, that's also something that's, I grew up with a lot of Catholic Christianity. And I feel like for things you've done in the past, you're supposed to feel guilty for that. That's just how it is. And this guilt weighs you down. And just, he just says, this guilt means nothing. If you move in the right direction, all your sins will be forgiven and you can be a totally different person. And like you rightly said, Priyank, if we could remember our past lives, it would probably be a million times harder to do that.
Repent, Mike. We have to repent, isn't it?
Repent.
It's just such a it's a very tough outlook, isn't it, to be repentant. It's obviously horses for courses, Chris.
Yeah, I think that in the Christian faith was that practice of what is it they're called, confessions, I think, going into the confession place. That was introduced many, many years after Jesus as possibly a ploy to try to get people back into the churches because they were losing numbers at the time. But it's certainly not true Christianity, is it? There's an affirmation from, we're talking about affirmations from Yogananda, scientific healing affirmation, and it's maybe useful for people who are really trying to strive to change and to improve is, I relax and cast aside all mental burdens, allowing God to express through me his perfect love, peace, and wisdom. That's from the Scientific Healing Affirmations by Paramahansa Yogananda. It's a great, very powerful, short affirmation. Nobody can claim that they can't remember that off by heart.
Yeah, so much so that I use it virtually in every single one of my services that I lead. We're allowed to pick the prayer. And this is always the one I have as the opening prayer because I sense myself as being a bit restless at the start because of a long day of work and commuting and all those things. So I like to be relaxed and casting aside those mental burdens, just as Guruji has advised. Going back to this line, the vanished lives of men are dark with many shames. So much in that, isn't there? Well, we touched on it in terms of our inability to remember what we have and have not done in the past. But equally, the opposite may also be true. The vanished lives of men may have really beautiful elements and really light elements that we obviously are benefiting from, because we're here on this spiritual path with our guru guiding us in this life, where, you know, most of humanity don't have this privilege and this joy, do they? So that's something that we can, a parallel we can draw from that. So not just in terms of our unworthiness, but also our worthiness to be here. Mm-hmm. Great, we have great good karma to be here, as I think Brother Ananda Moy said. And then it says, human conduct is ever unreliable until anchored in divine. I think I this is now, I think, referring to every time you trip and fall in this life, of which there will be many times. And this is really nice consolation that Sri Yukteswar is saying, that human, essentially, unreliability is synonymous with human conduct. So don't feel so bad. Not that we should encourage it, but we should also not beat ourselves up because of our inconsistent endeavors. Mark and Chris,
capitalizing this concept is a line that I remember very clearly. It's a saint is a sinner who never give up, and that line is just so, it just has so much wisdom just encapsulated in such few words, and very relatable for everybody, really, because, yeah, as you say, you can easily weigh yourself down by your wrong past actions, but it is not what we're taught to do.
Yeah, and there are many powerful concepts that if our mind embraces them, and I don't know why that is, but it seems like the negative concepts, our mind is always super happy to embrace quickly, and the positive ones, they take a bit more work. And so if you have doubt creeping in, it's very powerful, and it keeps you really from doing the right thing and doing it with conviction. So it's a very dangerous thing that needs to be thrown out on all levels.
We're going to have I've got a nice reading on doubt and the problems that doubt causes us. But let's finish this line. The next line is, everything in the future will improve if you're making a spiritual effort now. This, I think, so the previous line was, human conduct is ever unreliable until man is anchored in the divine. This really explains why we're here and why we continue to be here. I not self-realized, not released, not in Nirvikalpa Samadhi. But this line is really one of hope, isn't it? Really one for the ever-present now, which is, you could just, I feel like you could, it could, this could just be used virtually every moment of your life. If you're making some sort of effort into walking, you know, trying to face God and God and gurus, whether it's just repeating their names, or whether it's, you know, you're doing your spiritual practices, everything in the future will improve if you're making a spiritual effort now. You could just keep saying it to just revitalize your effort, remotivate yourself, and renew your faith. It's just such a powerful line. No wonder, as Mike said, this is one of Sri Yukteswar's most oft quoted lines, isn't it? Forget the past. The vanished lives of men are dark with many shames. Human conduct is ever unreliable until man is anchored in the divine. Everything in the future will improve if you are making a spiritual effort now. So this little paragraph started with doubt. A new devotee would express doubts as to his worthiness to engage in yoga practice. But obviously the doubt itself is a very limiting quality. And so the Paramahansa Yogananda really goes to town in explaining why doubts are a problem for us on the spiritual path. So in chapter, in God Talks with Arjuna, chapter 4, verse 40, says, "The ignorant, the man lacking in devotion, the doubt-filled man ultimately perishes. The unsettled individual has neither this world, nor the next, nor the supreme happiness of God." So Guruji, or Bhagavan Krishna, literally compares here doubt with those that are lacking in devotion, and saying that they're ignorant essentially, and ultimately we perish if we stay in that state of doubt. And not just perish, we then can't enjoy this world, nor can we enjoy the next, because we have to be reborn in this one. And at the same time, there is essentially no supreme happiness in God, which is really tough to swallow, isn't it? So let's really explore that. I think we'll end it with this description of this verse from God Talks with Arjuna, and then we can end it there. Mike, do you want to take us through it?
Yeah, you're right, Brent. He's going to town. He says, "The man of doubt or irresolution is even worse off than the man who is habitually ignorant and does not know any better. The latter is placidly content in his ignorance. The man with an unsettled mind, however, lacking commitment to anything, neither enjoys the innocent joys of the earthly life, nor is he eligible for the joys of the hereafter, because astral happiness is a reward for man's earnest endeavors in performing good deeds on earth. The man of doubt is restrained by inertia, paralyzed into inaction. He remains stationary, a motionless object, out of harmony with a world in constant flux.
It is better to work hard for material accomplishments than to not work at all. The man of action receives various benefits by exercising his mental and physical faculties. A man of spiritual action goes definitely forward. But the man with a doubting disposition depresses all his desires for activity. As Shakespeare said, our doubts are traitors and make us lose the good we oft might win by fearing to attempt. By lack of motion, he converts himself almost to a state of paralysis, hardly a man at all. A human being has been sent into a world of activity and motion. Unless he pursues spiritual motion and action by relinquishing doubts, he cannot progress.
Doubts are the result of man's responses to the influences of delusion on his intelligence. When expressed through nature's principles of mind, intellect, and senses, intelligence lacks the capacity and quality of direct cognition. It may be compared to the light of a lighthouse, appearing only intermittently in intervals of darkness. Alternate states of the light of conviction and the darkness of doubt. If the light of intelligence were steady within man, he would, without effort or doubt, understand truth in all things. But since the rays of intelligence are oscillating with the darkness of delusion, the ordinary man remains most of the time in a state of doubt, causing irresolution and fierce loyalty to misconceptions.
Girl.